Good morning. Welcome to Lake Country Unitarian Universalist Church in beautiful downtown Heartland, Wisconsin. My name is Mike Santo, and I'm the board rep for this morning's service. We have a variety of announcements about church life and activities, which I will read to you as soon as I find them up here. Apparently, we do not have a variety of announcements about church life, which is fine, so we can move on. There are announcements, however, inside your order of service on the, let's see, would be the fourth page, or third page. I invite you to greet those sitting around you. If you are a visitor this morning, we particularly welcome you. Please sign the guest ledger on the visitor's table in the front foyer. There is a variety of information available on that table about our church and Unitarian Universalism. Help yourself to any that interests you. I will be in the social hall after the service if you have any questions about our church, or if you have been visiting for a while and would like information about how to become a member. That would be great. I'd be happy to talk with you about that as well. If you're visiting with your children, it is our custom for the children to remain with us until after the offertory, at which time they go to their religious education classes. And the children will be in one class together today. Your child is welcome to join them or remain in the service with us. If you would like to go along to observe your child's class, please do so. The nursery is just out the doors to my right on the other side of the foyer, across the entryway, if there is a need for child care during the service. If there are any visitors who are comfortable introducing themselves, now would be a good time to do that so we can warmly welcome you to our church. Any visitors? Sparse crowd today. Yes? No. Okay. Hi. Everyone is invited to gather in the social hall after the service for refreshments and conversation. The conversation corner is a good place to gather for further discussion of the service. And we ask you now to please put your cell phones on some kind of silence mode during the service. I hope you find this morning's service inspiring. And today we're going to have a service taken off the Church of the Larger Fellowship, which is a website that our church has rights to. And the sermon today will be by the Reverend Judith A. Walker Riggs. Hooray for Failure is the name of it. It will be presented to us today by the worship committee member, the very Reverend Dr. Paul Facklin.
Thank you. The opening words are from William Carlos Williams' poem, The Descent. This is a difficult poem, but if you think of this as an image in your head of the year as an arc, and we're now in the descent of the year, that might help some. The descent beckons, as the ascent beckoned. Memory is a kind of accomplishment, a sort of renewal even, an initiation, since the spaces it opens are new places inhabited by hordes heretofore unrealized, of new kinds, since their movements are toward new objectives, even though formerly they were abandoned. No defeat is made up entirely of defeat, since the world it opens is always a place formerly unsuspected. A world lost, a world unsuspected, beckons to new places, and no whiteness lost is so white as the memory of whiteness. With evening, love wakens, though its shadows, which are alive by reason of the sun shining, grow sleepy now and drop away from desire. Love without shadows stirs now, beginning to awaken as night advances. The descent, made up of despairs and without accomplishment, realizes a new awakening, which is a reversal of despair. For what we cannot accomplish, what is denied to love, what we have lost in the anticipation, a descent follows, endless and indestructible. Please join us now in the chalice lighting song. We'll sing this together. It's printed in your order of service. I'd like to invite the children to come forward for the story of all ages. Come on, right down to the front here. Good morning. Now, how many of you guys are successful at everything you do? Are you good at everything? You ride a bike, you can read any book that's ever given to you? No, not yet?
No one's perfect at it.
Ah. How many of you have failed at something? Yeah. Yeah. Everybody seems to fail at something. So I'm gonna tell you about a failure I had. So in the third grade, I decided to teach myself origami because I liked origami. Do you know what origami is? It's the art of paper folding. And you're like, how hard can it be to fold a piece of paper? So I thought I would make something in origami, and I thought I'd teach myself because I knew how to read. So I'm going to give you each a piece of paper, and I'm going to teach you what I learned how to make. Okay, so everybody's got their piece of paper there. Let me get my piece of paper here. And so I read the directions, and You all know about valley folds and mountain folds and things like that. So, yeah, you fold. Okay. You sound like you've done this before. Well, I had not done this before. So I folded the paper. I folded it this way. And I folded it back. And I kind of folded it around. See, why don't you hold your paper like this? Everybody get their paper horizontal like this. Okay, now take it. This was my ending design. I got the paper like this. And I did that because I got really frustrated with trying to figure out the directions. So go ahead and crumple yours up. See if you can make this. This was a new invention. Go ahead and crumble it up. Feels good, especially after you've folded for a long time and you haven't successfully gotten your shape. And what I had then was what is known as an origami boulder. Each one's pretty unique. And, you know, I had a basket, so
I made a lot of these. And so why don't you guys try and pitch in there? Oh, very good. Whoa. Go ahead. How close? Here, you can try again. You can try again. Excellent. You want to try? Come on. Okay. I found this was more fun than actually doing the origami. So why don't we do that again? But why don't we make it more challenging? How about if we put the basket over here? Okay, now try. Give it a shot. Close. Come on, one more. Go for it. Yes! Yeah, so after my failure at origami, I also learned I would not be a basketball star. Oh, no. Can you go get it? I also discovered, despite the fact that I made many origami boulders and pitched them at my basket, that I would not be a basketball star either. So there's a lot of things we don't do perfectly. But that was fun. So what was it easiest? Was it easy to shoot into the basket? Like if I handed this around, would you've all made it?
Yeah, probably.
But when I moved it further away, was it harder or easier?
It was
pretty hard. Yeah, but was it more fun when it was harder?
Yeah.
Yeah, because I mean if it's right here and you just toss paper in.
It's harder when it's harder.
Yeah, I think it's a lot more fun when it's more challenging. So how did you feel when you missed though? Did you feel kind of bad? Like, that wasn't perfect. But were you ready to try again?
Yeah,
that's why I brought lots of paper so I could make more origami boulders and just keep trying. So, I mean, eventually that's what I did. I shot baskets. So small triumphs like that are important. So making a basket, something like that, is kind of important. And what's interesting is that the failure to do something takes the same courage as it does to do the success. It takes the same amount of strength to throw the ball at the basket, whether you're going to make it or not. So what makes a good challenge? So what makes something challenging? Go ahead.
Like math.
What makes it challenging? Is it because it's really, what's 2 plus 2?
4.
Ah, okay. So is that challenging?
Not really.
Okay, what's 9 times 800?
9,000?
Close.
7,200.
Very good. See, that one was a little more challenging. You had to think about it. Yes. You know the answer? What's 7 times 5? That would be very challenging. Yes. That would be very challenging. So how many of you know how to read? Okay. Are you fairly new to reading, Caleb? You can read pretty well? Okay, let's see if you can read this. We're going to give you a shot. So can you read this? Can you read the words? Not yet? Okay, can you read this?
See Dan plant a tree,
go green, Dan. See, that's new modern reader. Was that very difficult to read?
Not too.
Was it exciting?
Nah. Okay.
Okay, so I'm going to give you something harder. Okay.
Oh.
Okay. Do you want to try this?
Six.
Yeah, that one's, what do you say? That one harder?
Yeah.
More fun?
Yeah.
Okay, so that was pretty good. That one's hard to say. That one's a tongue twister. Yeah. So it's not hard because of the words.
It's just
each word. It's hard to say them all together. So now I'm gonna give you this one. So you guys can read. What does that say?
It says Chinese on it, I think.
Maybe it goes like this. Does that help?
Not really.
Yeah. So I've learned to read, and I've been reading for a long time, and I cannot read this. And I believe it's Japanese. Yeah, I'm not even sure if it's Chinese symbols, Japanese. I believe it's Japanese. So, yeah, there's a lot of things. So there's always a new challenge out there. So you know how to read a little bit. You can read really hard sentences. You can say them out loud. But now it's time to learn another language, maybe, or move on to other things. So I'm going to tell you about a person that many of you have heard of. And in fact, you can take a look at her, see if you remember who she is, because I'm sure you've all had history. So there's a picture of her. Do you recognize her? Very famous. Okay, I'm going to give you a hint. Do any of you have, let's see, is it 50 cent piece? It's a dollar coin. Susan B. Anthony. That's Susan B. Anthony. So everybody hears about Susan B. Anthony. She's on a coin. You occasionally get the dollar coin. And you read about her. She was born in 1820, so quite a long time ago. And she joined the women's rights movement in 1852. So she's a bit older than all of us. And so she was 32 years old when she joined the women's rights movement. And then from 1869 to 1906, that was for 35 years, she would go to Congress every year. And she would ask them to pass a law to do what? You know? Yes? To give women equal rights, the right to vote. Every year for 35 years. So how many of you are planning to ask your parents for something for 35 years? Every year you go, Mom, Dad, can I have a car? Think you do that for 35 years? So she did that. Now then, Susan B. Anthony died in 1906. How many women had the right to vote at the federal level at that time?
Half the women?
None. There was no law passed at that time. So she went in front of Congress every year for 35 years, and what did she get? She got nothing. So nothing from Congress. They didn't pass the law. The 19th Amendment was passed in 1920. So that's quite a ways after. So 14 years after she died. So why is she important? I mean, did she sound like she was successful?
No, she tried to be successful.
She tried, that's right. So she tried over and over again, 35 years, over and over. And she wasn't successful immediately in getting what she wanted, but she was determined, and she kept trying. And so this is something to think about. Sometimes some of the things we want to do, we aren't going to be successful in our own lifetime. But it's something that we can look on and we can train other people to be successful, to think about the things we're thinking about and care about those things. And so that's why she's really important, because she got other people to be active and move on with life. So think about this. What if we put this basket on Mars? Would that be more challenging? So then we'd have to build that rocket ship to send our origami boulders to hit the basket. And what if we made origami like this, instead of like boulders?
That's hard.
That would be a little more difficult. It's a better challenge.
I think a lot of little.
Yeah, and I can tell you what this foreign phrase says, because I actually looked it up. So this says, fall down 7 times, get up 8. So what do you think that means? Go ahead.
It
means you keep trying. So fall down 7 times, you get up 8. You get up one more time, then you fall down. Every time you fall down. So I want you guys to go out and challenge yourselves. This is right before the New Year's. People come up with resolutions, things they want to do. I want you to think about what you're going to do this year and not be afraid to try something new and something hard, different. So thank you very much. Please stand as you are able and join in the singing of hymn 360.
Offertory words are from number 674. Let there be an offering to sustain and strengthen this place, which is sacred to so many of us, a community of memory and of hope, for we are now the keepers of the dream. The offering will now be received.
Now we come to the time in our service where we take a few minutes and share our joys and concerns from the past week or whenever. And if you've got a great joy or a deep concern you'd like to share, we'll pass the mic around. I'll light a candle. Please tell us your name. And I'll light the first candle to honor those people who have been killed in conflict and in hopes that we can find a better way.
I'm Amy. Please light a candle of joy for the Christmas service that you put together the other night, John. Thank you.
I'm Carolyn Wagner. Could you please light a candle in memory of our my father-in-law, Duke's dad, and grandpa, whose presence we missed this year at Christmas. Could you also light a candle of gratefulness for the year 2009 and all of the safety and abundance that our family has enjoyed this year?
I'd like to light a candle of joy for this time of year when there's so much family togetherness. All our boys came home for the holidays, and it's always wonderful to share the family togetherness. So after your kids leave home, then you appreciate that a lot. And I'll light one more candle for the joys and concerns that we keep in our hearts today. And if you have any joys and concerns that you would like to share with Reverend Jane, she always welcomes that too.
I want to take a moment now for us to reflect on the following words, which I think many of you will find familiar, but out of their normal context. So let's pause a moment, listen, and reflect on them. In the clearing stands a boxer, a fighter by his trade. He carries the reminders of every glove that laid him down or cut him till he cried out in his anger and his shame, "I am leaving, I am leaving," but the fighter still remains. Today's sermon comes from the Church of the Larger Fellowship by Reverend Judith A. Walker Riggs. And I didn't really find out who she was or when she wrote this. This is you'll notice that some of the dates are a little older, and there's a lot of British references in here. But I enjoyed this sermon, and I hope you do as well. The Royal Society for the Prevention of Accidents held an exhibition at Harrogate in 1978. The entire display fell down. This is a sermon for all of you who have read all those books on how to be a success, and for all of you who haven't read them, but know deep down in your hearts that it's some sort of failing that you have not. For this is a sermon about how it is perfectly all right to be incompetent for hours on end, because I am, and so is everyone I know. Even that famous jack-of-all-trades, master-of-nothing, Mr. George Plimpton, who in 1975 perfected the most spectacular firework ever, a Roman candle weighing 720 pounds. It was 40 inches long and designed to break the record for fireworks. It succeeded. Lighting it, Plimpton confidently predicted that it would go up over half a mile. In reality, it hissed, whistled, and finally blew a 10-foot crater in the earth. My friends, you and I, and everyone else, fail. Our self-sealing envelopes work best when we've forgotten to put the account number on the check. Our spilled drinks stain the only important papers on the whole desk. And our cat's hair adheres to everything but the cat's. We all look terrible for the first 72 hours after a haircut. In a classic shoe cartoon, little Skyler, his young nephew, sits at a desk pondering his recently returned test paper. And the caption says, "Churchill did badly at English. Einstein once flunked math. At the rate I'm going in Spanish, I'll be the next president of Mexico." One man who knows all of us failures very well is Stephen Broadbent, founder and first president of the Not Terribly Good Club, of Great Britain. He was impeached in a later year when, at their annual banquet, he inadvertently stopped a soup tureen from falling over. Prowling through a bookstore in England one recent summer, I came upon Broadbent's marvelous Yearbook of the Club. It's a sort of reverse Guinness Book of World Records. Everything in Broadbent's book is true, verified, and witnessed, just like in Guinness. But Broadbent's book is of the least and the worst, not the most and the best. Like the least successful attempt to find the Loch Ness Monster. In 1985, four firemen from Hemel Hempstead tried to find the Loch Ness Monster by seducing it. Believing that feminine wiles would lure the beast from the deep, they built a 30-foot-long, blue and green, painted, papier-mâché female monster, equipped with long eyelashes and an outboard motor and a pre-recorded mating call. "Sex solves everything," said one of the firemen. The monster set off in search of romance with two firemen inside, steering. They traveled 15 miles, offering flirtation and mystery, but encountered only sustained hormonal indifference from the deep. Perhaps this was in part due to an outboard motor fault during the voyage that sent the monster into such a spin that it veered off backwards and crashed lengthwise across a jetty. Broadbent points out, no woman is at her best under such circumstances. Broadbent concludes that what human beings are best at is failure, incompetence. It is, he says, the quality that marks us off from the animals. He admits that the occasional Segovia does slip through the genetic net, and we line up for tickets to see him play the guitar flawlessly. In real life, however, all the rest of us spend hours replacing broken strings, and then people wish we hadn't. In 1978, workers were sent to remove the rubbish from the bottom of the Chesterfield Stockwith Canal. They worked half the morning and then took off for a tea break. They were interrupted mid-cup by a police officer who asked for their help in investigating a report on a giant whirlpool in the canal. When they got back, the whirlpool had gone, and so had the canal. There was just this long stretch of mud filled with old prams, tires, bicycles, and an army of irate holidaymakers stranded on hundreds of boats in a bed of brown sludge. Turns out that one of the first pieces of junk the workers removed was the 200-year-old plug that kept the water in the canal. Broadbent writes, "I am sure that I am not the only one who cannot do things, and the slightest investigation reveals that no one else can do anything either. This being the case, it seems to me that humanity spends a disproportionate amount of time talking about the things they do well, when these few blades of grass are surrounded by vast prairies of inadequacy, which are much more interesting." The residents of Bennett Court, an old folks' home in Otley, Yorkshire, ordered a fence around the home to give them more privacy. The city council sent a truck full of workers who took 5 days to put up a 12-foot-high, 100-yard-long fence. As they finished, they suddenly noticed that they had left no gap to drive their truck back out. "It was like watching a Laurel and Hardy film," said Mrs. Elizabeth Ann Whitaker, who watched it all from her upstairs window. "You could see them looking at the fence, then at the truck, then at the fence again. Some of us had wondered about the truck, but we didn't want to interfere." A city council spokesperson said it was an oversight. They'd gotten carried away with their work. The next day, the workers tore part of the fence down and retrieved their truck. As Murphy said in his 11th law, it is impossible to make anything foolproof because fools are so ingenious. We are all flawed. We all fail. How hard, then, to live in a culture that makes success, winning, so important? A friend watching the Rose Bowl parade this year noticed how we can't just watch lots of gorgeous floats. We have to award prizes to the best. And every band was introduced by listing the competitions it had won. We wouldn't listen to them till we knew that. The not-so-hidden implication of all of this? If you aren't first or best, or most, then you probably aren't worth anything. We don't even listen to the big successes when they tell us we've got it all wrong. Walt Disney wrote, "Being a success has never helped me make another good picture, or win the love of my daughter. It doesn't even seem to help keep fleas off our dog. And if being a success won't give me an advantage over a couple of fleas, then I guess there can't be that much to being a success after all. But we live in a culture that sets everybody up to be a loser in some artificial contest or other. And worse, this culture somehow communicates to us that having just one failure, a grade, a job, a mate, an election, short legs, thin hair, having just one failure means somehow that we are once and for all failures as human beings. Once a loser, always a loser. Loser equals failure, and failure is bad. But we all lose. We all fail. As Broadbent says, it's what we're best at. So what happens to us when we take those guaranteed failures and inadequacies, the ones we all have, and assume from them that we, maybe our whole families, are failures? We hurt. A lot. Shouldn't we be finding ways to prevent ourselves and, for heaven's sakes, our children from being sucked into this way of thinking? Dr. Kurt Richter of Johns Hopkins tells us of this experiment. Take any two rats. Hold one rat in your hand so firmly that no matter how valiantly he struggles, he can't escape. He'll finally give up struggling. Now throw that quiescent rat into a tank of warm water. He'll sink. He won't try to swim. He'll drown. He has learned that there's no point in struggling. Now throw the other rat in the water. That one has not learned that struggling is useless. That rat will swim to safety. When, where, and how did you learn to give up on certain things in your life? Is that knowledge valid, or could some of it be false? Could there be areas of your life where you assume that you will always be a failure, but it doesn't really have to be that way, any more than that rat needs to drown? You know the old maxim, you never know what you can do till you try. The opposite, I suspect, is at least equally true. You never try till you know what you can do. But don't we all tend to move towards areas of previous success and away from the areas where we didn't get it right? Well, that's not all bad. There's some good wisdom to learning when to give up. In some recent tests with school children, they were given a variety of problems. Some were real problems with correct answers, but some were fake problems, completely impossible and insoluble. The students considered below average, with usually poor grades, gave up right away, not only on the impossible problems, but also on the easy ones. Meanwhile, the good students, those with higher grades, popular with the teachers, from a good home, that sort of student, solved the problems, the simple problems, right away. But then they kept plugging away at the impossible problems, on and on, on and on, getting more and more desperate, more and more frustrated. They had been taught so well to work hard and be persistent that they didn't know when to stop trying. Yet there are some things it is no good keeping on at. For instance, recurring decimals. You'll never get to the end. Some days you should, as Pierre Salinger said, quit while you're still behind. I know that I'm going against the tide in this. I know that we are surrounded in our culture by those who would tell us that failure is never necessary. There are books and even religions on the market today that tell us how to control absolutely everything and have a nothing but successful life. Think positive, concentrate, they say, and you can get everything you want. I know there's a danger to what I suggest. Accept failure? Aren't you just playing into the hands of those who have already chosen to make being a failure their big success in life? Those like Ashley Brilliant when he says, "The best thing about my lack of progress is that I can't fall back very far." How am I helping people whom life has made so frightened of happiness, of success, that they have learned to relish the power of being the most successful failure in the world? It's a form of power, you know, playing poor me. I know these dangers, but nothing is perfect, certainly not me. And this is something that, danger and all, I have to say, because there is so much failure in the world, in us, and we are so often so hard on each other and ourselves about it. We all fail, even when there is no payoff. In July 1978, bank employees at Sherman Oaks, California, outwitted a robber when they refused to accept his suspicious package. They watched in relief as the security guard chased him out of the bank. Outside, however, a bystander saw the would-be robber running out,
assumed he had just robbed the bank, and gave chase. He tackled the robber. He left two bystanders sitting on him and carefully ran back into the bank with the package. Unfortunately, the package contained tear gas carefully timed to explode mid-robbery. It took over an hour to clear the bank of the gas. Sir Robert Watson Watt, the Scottish inventor of radar, while in Canada, made a speech about how to make discoveries, and he was arrested there for speeding, caught in a radar trap. He attached this to his ticket. Pity Sir Robert Watson Watt, strange target of his radar plot, and thus, with others I could mention, a victim of his own invention. Sometimes, even doing our very best, we fail. In another cartoon, Pogo says, "We have faults which we have hardly used yet." As someone else says, what we need is more failure, not less, for learning from success just builds mental pride. It's learning from failure that builds mental health. Could it be that if we redefine those words, success and failure, we could learn to better manage our failures, failures we are probably going to have a lot of anyway? How about adopting Winston Churchill's definition? Success is the ability to go from failure to failure without losing enthusiasm. Or Robert Louis Stevenson's, our business in life is not to succeed, but to continue to fail in good spirits. How many barriers in your life might such a sentiment remove? If you don't need to be successful every minute, maybe you could try playing the piano, playing tennis, fighting City Hall over something that matters, or even working for a better world. Perhaps there's wisdom and joy in O.K. Chesterton's motto, if a thing's worth doing, it's worth doing badly. Maybe Marge Piercy was right when she said, it is better to wrestle with a bear and lose than with a sparrow and win. Enjoying failure might free us to try new things. We might even succeed at some of them. And we might even be helping evolution along as we go. Because there's good news from people who tell us that failure is not only okay, but it's actually necessary. The famous biology writer, Lewis Thomas, tells us that failure is built right into the life process through DNA. The capacity to blunder slightly, he writes, is the real marvel of DNA. The molecule of DNA was ordained from the beginning to make small mistakes, mistakes that led ultimately to the evolution of human beings. It is only the mistakes that ever lead to anything new and different. Without this capacity for error, he writes, we would still be anaerobic bacteria. There would be no music. Thomas then suggests that evolution might never have taken place if human beings had been in charge of the DNA molecule. We would have made one fatal mistake, he says. Our molecule would have been perfect. It never would have occurred to us, thinking as we do, that the thing had to make errors. If we were not provided with a knack of being wrong, he writes, we would never get anything useful done. The luckiest days in the laboratory are the days when someone makes a mistake that suddenly everybody learns from. Now, failure is not always cute. Failure is not always gentle. Failure is not always okay. Some failures, like malfunctions on NASA shuttles, have no redeeming features. But for most of us, failure is inevitable and should not be the end of anything, not our trying and not our enjoyment of life. Perhaps we should let the following case history be our example. Can you name this man? Failed in business at age 22. He was then defeated for the legislature at 27, for speaker at 29, for elector at 31, and for Congress at 34. So far, so bad. After finally winning a congressional term at 37, he promptly lost the seat at 39, lost a Senate race at 46, and was nosed out for vice presidency at 47. He lost a second Senate race at 49. Would you hire this man? Who was he? Abraham Lincoln. The next election at age 51 made him the second youngest president ever. Think about him when you blow something in the week to come. And remember, in the freedom to fail,
In the freedom to try something challenging and new, there is life. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. Please join in hymn number 322. We have time for a polylog today. I was wondering if anybody would like to share some of this year's failures and possibly their resolutions for the coming year. If you'd like to, bring around a microphone. And you can also comment on the sermon.
Hi, my name's Susan. Thanks for the sermon today. It's exactly what I needed to hear. Where do I begin on the failures? Probably the biggest one is I lost my career 13 years ago. And I have not found another, despite all my looking, searching, praying, whatever. Just can't find it. Very frustrating. Some days I do enjoy life anyway, but it's an ongoing challenge. So thank you for the hope and the inspiration.
You're welcome.
Thanks for presenting that, Paul. One I found most profound, the idea that it's the failure of DNA that really results in the evolution and the success in the end of things, life forms evolving and getting better. And I'm reminded in this, too, of, when I worked in corporate America, that every year we would, no matter how good the year had been and how successful we had been in our previous year's goals, there's this expectation always that the goals have to be just beyond reach. And it's like email, that somehow you're supposed to be caught up with it and you're supposed to meet this goal. And in the end, it's sort of knowing that it's always impossible, it becomes sort of, it takes out almost the incentive or the desire to succeed because you just know you can't. And I don't know, just reminded that it's kind of pervasive out throughout our whole culture, and all of our organizations all have these impossible goals sometimes. But.
Definitely, there was the quite a while ago the Peter principle was raised, which is we rise to our level of incompetence. So exactly as you say, if you're good at something, you're immediately stepped up to a new and more difficult challenge. And then if you succeed at that, you move on to the next challenge, and they keep raising the bar until you literally are not successful at something. And that's the Peter principle. You rise to the level that you can't do.
Paul, I was reminded of a complaint that the monks of St. John's Abbey up in Collegeville, Minnesota had, which was the fact that it was the largest abbey in the world, at least when I joined it. It had over 320 monks, and it was also one of the wealthiest. They could afford Marcel Breuer as an architect to build a lot of the buildings up there. And given that kind of success and sort of, I don't want to say aggressive Catholicism, the place was also very liberal, and they had sent monks over to Rome to write documents for the Second Vatican Council. That the monks were always complaining to the abbot about having to succeed all the time. The fact that if you didn't have your doctorate, or if you basically just wanted to stay at home in the abbey rather than go out to a parish or to go to a mission or something, that there was something wrong with you if you just wanted to be a monk. I find that interesting, that even in a setting where one is supposed to withdraw from the world and focus on spiritual values, that even there you're expected to succeed somehow, no matter what it was. And anyway, so I found that interesting and refreshing, and thank you for presenting that, because that was great to hear.
Thank you.
I'm Greg. Thanks, Paul. I enjoyed that a lot. I thought that was really interesting. I think part of what I liked about it, or the part that appealed to me, was the sort of message of mental health, of just accept your failures, roll with them, we all fail. And, of course, we all think that's a sensible message, and we all applaud that. But there was something ironic in there, too, and I don't know if she intended it or she just got trapped. But that notion... the primary reason to teach our children and ourselves to fail better is so we can ultimately succeed more. I mean, that was embedded in there somewhere, in the notion that if we just get more comfortable with our failures, then ultimately we'll be big successes. And there's some kind of sick message in that part of it, I think. And that's the trap of it, which is I think a lot of us think we tell our children, go ahead and it's okay to fail because then you'll really become someone someday. And so maybe there's an American disease in her anti-American message somewhere in there. So anyway, I couldn't resist that one.
It's definitely problematic. I think some of the pieces you have to try and balance out what is the concept of failure. Failure is a way of moving on. And so not necessarily being goal-oriented, I won the game, but more a process that will go on and on. So your success, or what you think of as success, is hitting a goal, is probably the most problematic part, as opposed to just thinking, I'm doing something, I'm trying, I keep working at it. But yeah, there's definitely problems embedded in there.
Hi, Paul. My dad, who was mentioned earlier, was an enigmatic parent, in that he, as I have watched him through my life parenting me, he was a very strong self-critic and projected that out, so that when there was a mistake, it was, by him, experienced more like a crisis, because he was really good at incompetence and truth. He was a tool and die maker, and he seemed to be really good at that, but everything else that he did in life, he didn't do too well with it. And as his child, I experienced... Well, he was bipolar too, so I experienced this heavy contrast, and I've had a real tough relationship with mistakes in my life. And I think that what I wanted to say, especially with that as background, was that it's the emotional content, or the circumstance that I think children experience around they're learning and they're making the mistakes that they must be made in order to learn, that brings that serious quality that binds us to more failure potentially, because, you know, we've just taken it so seriously and it's so important and all of that. And so I like the levity that this approached the whole concept with.
Thank you.
My name is Jesse Knox, and I was taking a parenting class called Love and Logic, and one of the things I took out of that was how kids are made to make mistakes. And if you think about all of us, where we began, and infants to toddlers to childhood and beyond, that maybe we all were made to make mistakes. And as a parent, that's been so refreshing. So instead of trying to correct my children and keep them from making mistakes, as long as they're affordable and safe to make, that's really where the learning happens, you know. And better for them to make them when they're young and help them through how to solve and manage their mistakes and stay enthusiastic until the next one, that it's just such an important part of growing and being. So thanks for the service on that.
You're welcome. I suggest origami for affordable and safe. They're paper cuts.
Hopefully this isn't too redundant. I think you just spoke to this, but I really enjoyed the sermon, and I read an interesting book recently that looked at the neuroscience of learning and how there's been a lot of research done that really, you know, maybe we know it all intuitively, but now science has confirmed that mistakes are how we learn and how they're how we learn the best. So the irony is the way your brain is wired, the more you fail, the more you will succeed, because that's evolutionarily how our brains are set up. If we fail something, we learn more from that than success. And there's been more research done looking at children and test scores and how it can really dramatically affect a test score if a child is praised for effort over success. Just in a really small trial, it makes a huge difference. So praise people for their efforts.
I'm Diane. I was very interested in this sermon because of my tendency to be a wannabe perfectionist. I have not succeeded with that. My children call it the Germain gene because my mother was Germain, and it has passed down through three generations now, this need to be perfect, but we can't reach it. And now I'm going to be comfortable accepting that fact. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Hi, can you hear?
Yep.
Carlin, just wanted to say that I'm grateful every single day because I'm a teacher at a Montessori school with little 3 to 6 year olds for the last couple of years. And seeing the teacher and I who are in the classroom laugh every day. We are consistently entertained at the children's failures. It is such a riot. The language they come up with is amazing. The words and the, you know, well, you've got to decipher what it is that they're meaning, but it makes sense, you know, when you figure it out. And the mistakes with the materials. I mean, Montessori is very material oriented, very, very hands-on. And just watching them do the fine detail of, you know, like saying just pouring and seeing how they miss over and over it'll miss the other cup that they're pouring into, but they consistently keep doing it and doing it and doing it, and eventually they get it and they develop it. So I'm just really grateful every day to be witnessing that and to enjoy the humor of mistakes on a daily basis.
So I know the original intent of this talk was actually to bring up personal failures, so I'm willing to share one of my own. Rather recently, I found myself interested in this young woman that I met, and so I decided I wanted to try and contact her and to spend some time with her, get to know her. So I wrote her a nice note, and I sent it to her, and this was actually a handwritten note. This was very, very old-fashioned, you might say. I pored over this note for a good long hour, maybe, just trying to perfect the word choice of how exactly I'd like to phrase this and that, and how I'd sign off and so forth. And then I put it in the mailbox, and a couple days later, I realized that I put absolutely no contact information on this note, and so she had no way of responding. And so I, and so I have taken from this sermon that I've decided I'm going to give up on romance altogether, and I'll probably have more success.
We had our own Susan Bay Anthony moment this morning. Alex, who's very bright and will be going to college in 3 years, I've been telling her for years that I will not pay for her to go to school and that she has to find her own way. This morning, for some reason, we were on to this conversation yet again, and she looked over at Paul and she said, "Dad, will you pay for me to go to college?" And Paul said, "Yes." The expression on her face that she found this loophole, and the realization, of course, that he is the primary moneymaker in our family, too, all came to head for her. It was really quite amusing for us. So,
now for our closing words. Our closing words are from one of my favorite authors, Tom Robbins. So you think that you're a failure, do you? Well, you probably are. What's wrong with that? In the first place, if you've any sense at all, you must have learned by now that we pay just as dearly for our triumphs as we do for our defeats. Go ahead and fail, but fail with wit, fail with grace, fail with style. A mediocre failure is as insufferable as a mediocre success. Embrace failure. Seek it out. Learn to love it. That may be the only way any of us will ever be free. Thank you.
unto another time.